Hi there. Before we start, if you're new to our podcast, thank you for tuning in to our show and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, thank you so much for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. We're really grateful for all of your kind words and encouragement. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure as our mission is to create perspectives by the people who look like us and a woman, and also people who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify. And of course, leave a rating and a review if you like. We also welcome engagement through our Facebook and Instagram platforms. We truly appreciate the support from you to help us to increase the visibility of different perspectives. Enjoy today's show.
Hey y'all, this is Jessie.
Hi, this is Helen.
And we are Asian Bitches Down Under. Helen, it is a pretty grim weather aspect.
Yeah.
Freedom Week in Sydney. It's been pretty yes. much London weather we have here.
That's right.
Rainy, stormy, windy. But despite that, we have still got up, we still caught up to do pretty cool things now that Sydney has opened up. Both Helen and I went to see Shang-Chi at the cinemas. Mm-hmm. So I went to Palace Street because I thought the audience members would be more refined. I didn't want to be like sitting around with like teenage boys while I watched it.
You're being ageist.
But it was a lot of fun. We really enjoyed it. My favorite part of that, because we went to see it on Monday night. Mm-hmm. I just really wanted to celebrate the end of like 3 months of lockdown with my favorite thing to do, mm-hmm. going to see the cinemas. I don't know if this happened to you when you went, because Helen, you went on Tuesday night with your family.
Yes.
At the end of the movie, when the credits started rolling, everyone clapped.
Oh, really?
That's yeah, I know. Nice. And I was just like, I know, it was so nice. It made me feel like whole. Like, it made me feel like I was a part of something.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people were just so happy and celebratory. And it ended with, like, I don't remember the last time. I think the last time I sat through a movie theater where people clapped was like maybe at a film festival.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's which more is actually dedicated to the.
Yeah.
A whole production, yeah.
Yes, and it's actually not quite. It's not uncommon for audiences to clap after a premiere at a film festival.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it really felt like on Monday night. It felt so much like everyone coming out to see this amazing thing, and it was so. It just felt like such a humanity kind of coming together moment. Even though we were just watching like this pretty mediocre Marvel film.
Yeah, yes, we do consider that it's pretty. It's a very mid-range. It's not a very artistic film, but then again, it's like breaks the box office. I have here from a news source that Shang-Chi end up earning $100 million in just first 5 days. I think this is the US wow. record, and making it the fastest film to reach such a milestone since Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. So that was a couple of years ago. And also Shang-Chi has held the number one spot in the box office for like 4 consecutive weekends.
Awesome.
Yeah, so awesome. Marking it as the third MCU movie to pull off such a beat behind Guardians of the Galaxy and Black Panther. I think the reason that it's so popular this year is because, one, it's really hard to get into cinemas during the pandemics. And whenever that you want to see a movie at cinemas, like before COVID, we just pick whatever that's on and we choose the ones that we prefer to see. I mean, Marvel's always been like my family favorite anyway.
Right.
But I think it's been so popular, first of all, apart from its like 99% of Asian, like Asian cast, like all the Asians want to support this movie. And two, it's because we've been stuck. We've been stuck at home for so long. And when you want to go to the cinema, you want to have that cinematic experience.
Mm.
So
you don't want anything quiet, especially right. after 3 months of like a very muted life style.
Yeah. So
good point.
Yeah. So what do you think of the movie?
Well, okay, spoiler alert, obviously, because Helen and I have both seen it and we're going to... I mean, there's not really any spoiler alerts to conduct here, is there? Because there is no big twist at the end.
No, I think the plot is actually
standard.
Very standard. It's very, yeah, very there's standard. No much explosive things happening in the plot.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I have a lot of things to say about it. I guess very briefly, I'll sum it up by a few key points. Mm-hmm. First of all, I thought that Simu Liu was like really charismatic. I mean, he really didn't have a strong personality. But what I was mostly happy with was the fact that he came across as not an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, often these Marvel male characters, they're ostensibly superheroes. And traditionally, they have had kind of, they've said one or two lines of that kind of indicate they're sexist or racist,
yes,
or kind of narrow-minded,
mm-hmm,
in some way.
Yeah.
But the character of Sean, Shang-Chi, played by Simu Liu, he was just kind of like a nice bloke. Like, mm-hmm, there was nothing kind of alarming about him. There was no red flags about him. So, like, I liked his personality. I thought the storyline was very standard and basic, and there was, like, basically, I came out of it feeling like, oh, yeah, that was, like, pretty okay. Like, it didn't blow my mind. But I did like the fact that everyone in it was Asian, except for, like, the random Ben Kingsley. Ben Kingsley.
Ben Kingsley.
Yeah. He's such a random character in there. He's the only white character.
If you don't know,
actually,
have you watched? Do you follow Marvel movies?
No, I don't.
So the character he played in Shang-Chi is actually a previous character that appeared in Iron Man.
Okay. Oh right. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a connection in it, but he's such a funny character. Yeah.
Right. Well, I just found him like random and completely arbitrary. Like, I thought he was like, I think they injected him to have like a comedic relief,
yes,
you know, the Joker,
yeah,
obviously. But I just found him to be like, why was he even in the movie?
Mm-hmm.
The other white character was like this Hulk lookalike, sort of
psychic
Armenian, sort of. Yeah, he was the kind of the main kind of. He was Tony Leung. Tony Leung is Shang-Chi's dad, and he is like basically the enemy in the film.
Mm.
I swear Tony Leung is like ageless. He
yes,
looks the same as he was in 1950. Maybe he
wasn't
born in 1950.
Maybe,
but anyway,
20
yeah,
years ago, he still looks the
yeah,
same.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Just, oh my God, seriously. He is like the guy who does all the, he chases down the people that Tony Leung wants to chase down.
Mm.
He does the messy work. Another ageless character, Michelle Yao.
Mm-hmm.
She's just never going to age. Oh, my God. She looks the same as, like, when she was in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. Or is it Hidden Dragon, Crouching Tiger? I can never get it right. Bad Asian, Jessie too. I really enjoy the character of Awkwafina, obviously. She was funny.
Mm.
Although, I have to say, Helen, the one thing, the biggest complaint I had coming out, and I was telling Andrew after I came out of the cinemas,
mm-hmm,
was that I was really annoyed that they didn't make them kiss. You know,
oh,
like, I did not, I felt it, it made me feel like here we have the first, like, the reason why I was so keen about this movie was,
mm-hmm,
not because of Marvel, because I'm quite indifferent to Marvel, mm-hmm, films, but I wanted to see an Asian male Marvel lead, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Asian men cop the biggest shit in Western society.
Mm-hmm.
They're desexualized, they're infantilized, they're, like, racially discriminated against, like, they're never, you know, on dating apps, they're often the lowest,
mm-hmm,
ranking,
mm-hmm,
in terms of just, like, statistically speaking, who is most desirable.
Mm.
That's not my opinion. That's just,
that's
like,
a fact. No,
it's just the statistics.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't. Anyway, and so, like, I was, like, keen to see a very charming and, I guess, conservatively good-looking,
mm-hmm,
like, male Asian character, but I really wanted them to give him romance. Like, why can't he have, like, after he saves the fucking world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is weird because the world was just like a community of 30 people fighting like 20,000 weird looking demons /dragons. But anyway, he like bloody hell saves the world, and still he doesn't deserve a relationship at the end with his best friend. You know, like, I was annoyed that. Because, like, at the end of every Marvel movie, you see Captain America, you see Tony Stark, all these characters, they get to kiss,
mm-hmm,
their romantic interest.
Okay.
What I was annoyed by was that this film didn't allow Shang-Chi, Sean, the main character, didn't allow him to be desirable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there was hardly ever actually any sexual tension between him and Awkwafina's character,
mm-hmm,
which is so strange because, like, they're obviously close. They're obviously very loyal to each other. Like, come on, just give him a kiss. You know, just let him have some romance.
Mm.
He deserves it.
Okay,
you know?
Okay. That's actually quite the opposite of what I think. I thought it was nice that for the first time that they actually don't have a very explicit romance. I mean, we see the romance between Shang-Chi's parents at the beginning of the film, like this.
Yeah, which was very flirtatious. Just, can I just say, it was so weird.
Yeah, it's so strange.
It was just so fucking weird. That
martial arts and then...
Yeah, martial arts and flirting. Dancing. Yeah, I swear, the that scene, you didn't even know why they were attracted to each other. It was so weird.
I guess Asians don't have a very good communication skills to express themselves romantically, and they have to do it in a way that they... I don't know how to put it into the words, but they present themselves in the best form of themselves, as in trying to... Let's say if I... how am I going to explain it? You know how Asians express their love by doing things?
Yeah.
I think that's what they did by showing off how their martial arts skills is probably be represented or symbolized as the way they can protect or look after each other.
Right.
I'm guessing. I'm just putting like an assumption there. Yeah, but it was really funny. But coming back to a romance issue, I thought that was okay. I didn't really think that was too much of the problem, to be honest.
Okay, yeah. I have to say that was the main criticism I had of the film, because like I was like, can we not let two Asians kiss? Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, we see interracial couples, kiss.
Yeah.
But, like, why don't you let two Asians kiss? Like, do white people, can they not stand seeing two Asians kiss? Mm. You know, like, Asians can be attracted to Asians.
Yeah.
News alert, you know?
That's right. That's definitely true. Yeah.
Even at the end, you know, at the end when the circle guy, the guy who I know has been in other Marvel movies,
Doctor Strange,
dude,
Benedict Wong.
When he comes back and invites them into the new portal, Sean's character, like, he kind of, like, I thought he was going to at least, like, kiss Awkwafina or hold her hand before they go into the circle. Yet he just, like, kind of hooks his arm, like, and offers her an arm. It was just platonic.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is so, like, I don't know. Why can't two Asian people find each other sexually attractive? Can we not see that? Has the Western world not even... Can the Western world not stand two Asian people being attracted to each other? Like, come on, just think about Tony Stark and Captain America. They're, like, oozing with sexual appeal to, like, it's almost, like, mandatory that we have the romance in all these other characters, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, does Doctor Who have a character who he's in love with?
Is he sexualized? What, Doctor Who or Doctor Strange?
Oh, it's Doctor Strange.
Strange, yeah. He's not actually sexualized, but he did have a partner that he left behind in the human world.
Right, yeah, of course. I mean, the other thing, speaking of leaving partners, the other thing that Andrew and I were, like, eye-rolling with each other was, of course, the wife dies. Like, the woman is all, like, just when is the world going to stop writing stories, right, with mass appeal that does not involve a fucking woman dying, you know? I'm so fucking sick of that. Like, come on. The other week, we watched Interstellar, you know, and another, like, I swear, space films are the most egregiously toxic 21st century stories of masculinity.
I don't like them.
Honestly,
I fall asleep.
I fucking hated Interstellar so much for so many different reasons. But and, like, Ad Astra, I saw Ad Astra.
Oh, my God. We start watching that. Another fucking, I can't finish it.
Like, I know. It's awful. I swear, like, I'm never, space films. Someone should write an essay about the toxicity of space films. But it's the same thing. Like, every single one of these films that center a guy exploring the world, et cetera, et cetera, has to involve a woman dying. And I'm like, I'm so sick of it. Come on. Like, honestly, if one day, you know what, Helen? Andrew did remind me that Chloe Zhao has apparently been signed on to the next Marvel movie, right?
Yeah, she did.
So maybe things will change. But honestly, one day someone should, like, get me to write a Marvel film.
You have to go back and read, like, 50 years, half decades of comics to actually connect all the stories.
Oh my God, yeah. Don't bother. It's so, and I'm putting this out because apparently I read a article in SMH a few weeks ago where they profiled Simu Liu, and apparently that's how he got the job. Like, he tweeted at Marvel saying, hey, if you guys ever want.
Yeah, that's what he did. He tweeted and saying that there should be an Asian, you know, actual character in the Marvel film, and he got the
absolutely
part. Yeah. So what I think about the film is that, I going into the watching this film quite in a very political analysis. I don't know why.
Oh, I love it. But I love it. I can't wait to hear it.
My metaphor for the characters in the whole film is that the Mandarin, Wen Wu, which is Tony Leung's character, he's the CCP. And he idealized with power, control, and conquering other nations. And he fall in love with this woman in the very picturesque kind of village that I would metaphorically think as a depiction of Tibet or the minority tribes in China. And because the Taolo village is kind of portraying like a Shangri-La paradise, like, and it's very untainted heaven, and the location is very secure.
It's angelic. It's angelic. So just quickly, Helen, for those who haven't watched it, basically Tony Shang-Chi's dad falls in love with a woman in the Tao. What did you say? Tao Leung?
Yeah.
Tao Chi?
Well, village? The Chinese pronunciation is Da Luo, and it's actually actual mythical legend. So it's not, they didn't just make it up. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And it's basically like she is of a different kind.
Mm-hmm.
So he's falling in love with someone of a different tribe.
Yeah.
And okay,
then
keep going.
I do see Shang-Chi and Xia-Lin, which is his sister, as the Asian diasporas that left their hometown to pursue their own identity. But they failed to escape the very essence of embracing their own heritage, and then kind of like being kidnapped back by their dad.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the sister... who I've never seen before. Have you seen her? The girl who plays the sister?
No, she's pretty new. She's really new. Meng Er Chen. Chen Meng Er, I think. Yeah, that's her name.
She Macau. Escapes to Shanghai.
Macau.
Which is like the center of like casino, gambling, betting kind of world. And then Shang-Chi ends up in San Francisco, which is kind of where the movie kind of starts. And like that first scene with the bus is so good. I really like that bus scene.
Yeah, that was really good, yeah. And coming back to what I was talking about using metaphorical terms, I think it's kind of trying to display like a parental expectations from a lot of Asian parents. And at the same time, I think the whole movie, I know that the writers are Asian American, so you get this kind of how they display the whole story through eyes of Asian diasporas in the West. And it's still very attached to the idea of Kung Fu as a very stereotypical ideas of how Chinese story should be. So
of
course that we know it's a action superhero type of film, but it's very still very attached to Kung Fu, and there's a lot of in-depth Asian elements that you can see, like taking off the shoes when you're entering the house.
Yes, I really like that. I really like that.
The food aspects, education achievements, where Awkwafina's a character, she was like complaining about how much that her mom wants her to achieve, and also karaoke.
That was so good. Like at the end of the night, they decide to go sing karaoke, which by the way made me think, oh, I really need to go back to karaoke.
Yeah, I
haven't done it for ages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I have to say, there's a scene at the beginning when Sean/Shang-Chi's character goes to pick up Awkwafina before they go off to their
work,
job as valets. There's a scene where he goes to pick her up and she's living with her family and her waipo, her grandma. And then the camera, it was only like a 2-second scene.
Okay.
But the camera does a close-up of Shang-Chi taking off his shoes.
Yes,
And I just felt like, I know if you're white out there and you don't understand the impact of this, but just seeing that for me in a Marvel film was so kind of impactful, because it's like it's just such a daily routine embedded in our lives that we take off our shoes before we enter the house, but it's like such a fundamental core of what's part of who we are as a
identity
culture and what it means to take off the shoes.
That's right.
Taking off the shoes, I swear someone out there must have written like a whole book about what it means to take off a shoe. But it's like the symbolism. It's a gesture of like entering a house.
Yes.
You're going to leave the dirt of the outside world at the door.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to come in and you're going to be clean and you're going to be polite, respectful, dignified. And just all of that built up in that 2-second scene.
That's
of
right.
Him,
yeah.
The close-up shot of like, only Asians will get that, honestly.
Yeah. I think it's the same when we were watching Always Be My Baby with Ali Wong and Randall Parks. movie, that rom-com, where all the Asians I know picked up that 2 seconds when the kids runs out and runs in the house, they take off their shoes and then put on their shoes when they go out.
Yeah, exactly.
So funny.
Yeah. I honestly, even as an adult, sometimes, Helen, the idea of coming into a house, even when I like go to my friend's house or like my partner's house, family's house, and like they say, oh no, you don't have to take off your shoes, it feels like I'm committing a crime. Like, that's how much it means.
Like, this is strange.
I know, it feels so strange, like, to enter a domestic space with my shoes on. Mm-hmm. It still feels to this day, and I'm in my 30s now, it feels so strange to do that.
What do you do at the Airbnb? I bring my own slippers, you know. Yeah, I go to Airbnb. Yeah. I can't wear. Maybe at the public places like lounge or the kitchen, I'll still wear my shoes. Yes. But if I'm in the bedroom, I can't. I just don't feel like I need to actually wear the shoes. Yeah,
especially if it's like carpeted, hey.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I just want to mention about the ending. If anyone, spoiler alert again, we should put this on our notes. The ending, there were 2 Easter eggs, and the last one where it shows the last, I think it was like barely like 2 minutes, shows Xialin is the younger sister, returns to her dad's, well, how do you call that? Like a compound of training for his military.
Okay, wait.
Oh, so you didn't watch that?
Oh, my God.
You
didn't stay? Cinemas.
Oh, you didn't stay to watch the Easter eggs?
We stayed only up until after the doctor...
The Wan.
Dr. Wan wants. Talks to them about the thing, and then we didn't stay until the very end.
Okay, so there's another one.
Oh, my God, damn it. The second one. I'm really annoyed at Andrew. It wasn't his day. I wanted to leave.
All right, so do you want me to tell you?
Yeah, tell me.
Okay, so there was like 2 minutes brief scene of Xialin returns to her dad's compound.
Okay, yeah.
And you see her training young people, but both boys and girls.
Yeah.
Remember in the story that the dad said only boys are be trained?
Yeah, yeah.
So she wasn't being, she trained herself when she was growing up. That's why she hated the place.
Yeah.
But now she's taking over the place. You can see that she's training both girls and boys.
Mm.
And there were graffitis on the building, solar panels, satellites. It just, to me, it feels like a reflection of Asian diaspora kids returning to Asia and gentrify and westernize.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Or the area.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it seems so hip. It's like graffitis everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it just seems like being westernized rather than there's a lot of aspects in that whole shot where they gradually moves away from that court.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what happens? So anything funny?
No, it wasn't anything funny, but you just see that there's so much change to how the way that her dad did to the era, to the place, and compared to what she did to the place.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
So I guess it's like showing like a next generation taking up a pawn.
Yeah. I really love that you went into the film with the political lens, and because you know so much more about like CCP and, you know, Chinese kind of politics. I love that inflection that you gave it in your analysis. I want to say also that – what do I want to say? There's so many things I want to say. I love the kind of I don't love it, but I thought it was interesting that during the film she made little swipes at her brother. So basically her brother kind of left her when she was still like a teenager. And he had promised to go back to see her and save her, but he didn't. And so she, like, when he goes back to find her, she's a little pissed off at him. And there's this one scene where he, like, catches a baddie and tries to interrogate him, but then the sister just comes and pushes the baddie off the, like, scaffold where they were having this amazing scaffold scene fight.
Yeah.
And then she said to him, "What, has America made you soft?"
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's, like, small kind of digs at America. Because he's now like he has spent the last 10 years in America. So I thought that was really funny.
This whole movie didn't never really actually go into question why he stayed in America, or did I miss that?
I don't
feel like there was anything. Like, he was given a mission by his dad to assassinate someone in US, but then you never seen what happened to that mission.
You assume that he killed her. That he killed the guy who killed his mum. That's what he ends up confessing to Awkwafina. I thought that.
I see.
It's a really weird cast to cast Awkwafina in that, because she's just not a damsel in distress. And there was one scene where she does fall into, not on her own accord, it's the writers who did this, but there's one scene where she needs to be saved. And I'm just like, this is so not Awkwafina. Like, although in saying that, I did like the fact that they cast her, because, like, she's not the typical side girlfriend. I'm still going to call her the girlfriend, even though, like, they don't do anything romantic. I'm still going to say just, she's the romantic.
They don't seem there's a chemistry. You just don't feel like there's a chemistry.
Well, that's
she's
because like, the writers
like
made
a bro,
it that way.
This, like, the bro character, you know?
But also, like, their relationship is kind of the most healthy in all the Marvel
movies,
you know? That's why I was so angry that they were not allowed a romance. Like, give them romance, man. They deserve it. Like, why can't Asians also be attracted to each other? I'm just going to keep going back to that. It's so annoying that these, like, yes, you say that the Asian Americans who wrote this film, but at the end of the day, it's a Marvel movie. It's backed by Hollywood, therefore white people. Like, fucking make them kiss, for fuck's sake, you know? Like, I was just thinking, I was actually telling Andrew after the film, I was thinking, you know how before a movie is publicly released, this is a wonderful thing about movies that doesn't happen with books, for instance. You know how before a movie is publicly released, they show it to a bunch of people and then they get a survey of, like, what they think? And then, I'm thinking maybe they did shoot a few scenes where, like, there was romance involved, but then, like, maybe the audience oh, they didn't like it. Let's just, like, not give them some romance. You know, maybe? I don't know. But, like...
That's possible.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you saw it with your teenage son and then your, like, 8-year-old daughter. What did they think? Like, did they have any useful insights that you didn't see as a younger person?
I think my 8-year-old daughter, please don't attack me taking my kids to see a Marvel movie.
Well, are you kidding me? No way. I think that's great.
I think my 8-year-old child, she actually enjoyed that there's no romance because she hates seeing romance on movies. She dislikes any romance. I mean, I think she dislikes any heterosexual romance.
Yeah, okay.
She hates seeing princess and prince, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so she enjoyed that, like you said, the platonic kind of friendship between a guy and the girl.
Mm.
And my son, he said that, I don't know. He didn't have a big reaction. He said, oh, yeah, it's entertaining. It's very violent. You see a lot of martial arts. And he said that, I can tell that the writers grew up in the era where they watch Airbender, the Avatar, animation.
Yeah.
Because there's a airbender and a waterbender.
Mm.
Yeah, so I guess that's a reflection on that. And with the artistic presentation, it's quite nice, I think. All those, like, mythical creatures... They're all enjoying watching that kind of something that's different to what they see from Disney.
Yeah. I also have to say the little wombat, winged wombat, was really cute.
Morris.
The headless thing was fucking adorable. Yeah. I think I came out of the film being a bit annoyed that it was so martial arts centered. Like, as though Hollywood can only perceive Asianness through the lens of Chinese martial arts.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Like, it was very narrow in the way that they presented that.
Yeah. I think it's because the story is still very based on the Chinese culture rather than the rest of the Asian cultures.
Yeah.
Also, I don't know what's the, like, obsession from Marvel about the mystical stones and mirror type of materials that is very powerful to control and corrupt human. Like, in Endgame, there's the stones, there's Black Panther with some kind of mineral production in Wakanda as well. And Shang-Chi is this dragon scale, you know, that red thing that's on their weapons? Yeah.
Yeah. So. Final question for you, Helen, before we wrap this discussion up of this film. You know how Shang-Chi, the main character, you know how he's supposed to be Chinese?
Yeah.
So Simu Liu is Korean, I believe, right?
No, he's not.
What?
You think he's Korean because he was in King's Convenience, right?
Oh my god,
right?
This is so bad. No. Maybe you should delete this part. I'm going to be, like, so badly, like, bullied on Twitter. Okay, yeah, tell me what.
Yeah,
what
people mistaken him that he's Korean. Did that happen in the film as well? He made a joke saying that, people assume that I'm Korean, but I'm not.
Really?
It was a line in the film.
Oh, okay.
So he's Chinese.
Oh, okay.
He's Chinese. So he's from, I think he was from Harbin or Hunan.
Oh, yes, he did. I read that.
Yeah. He was living with his grandparents up until like before primary school.
Right, yeah,
when his parents were in
Canada.
Yeah. So they left him there for a couple of years before that they moved in with him. So I think there was still like a kind of like a conflict, family conflict or something that he wasn't happy about.
Right.
Being left behind.
Right.
Yeah. And funny that, you know, that this film is actually topped the box office with any... It hasn't been released to Chinese market yet, I think.
Wow, okay.
Let me see. What do I have here? Okay. Owing to the comments that the film star, Simu Liu, made a CBC 2017 interview that referenced a negative comment aspects about his parents living in China, the Chinese government excluded Shang-Chi from their list of upcoming MCU movies scheduled to release in its territories.
Oh my gosh.
So it's not yet. I don't know whether or not it will be released in China, but it's doing quite well even without China's market.
Wow. I mean, that says a lot, right? So we're going to take a break and we're going to come back and talk really briefly about the books we've been reading before we launch into this week's two topics we're going to talk about. Obviously, I'm like so eager to talk about this.
Yes, the whole
entire Western world is talking about it. It is the Bad Art Friend article story written by Robert Kohler, who's a sensational journalist from the New York Times. I actually want to spend some time talking about him as well as the story behind the Bad Art Friend. We're going to just basically tell you the basic story about it, what we think about it. Can't wait to hear Helen's thoughts. And then we'll wrap it up with a really quick wrap-up of the controversy about Sam Frost and anti-vax video that she posted on Instagram last week. We'll be right back. Okay, so I really just don't know sometimes how things get viral. You know,
yes.
I have to say, Bad Art Friend, this story is something that I'll tell you the genesis of how I came across it. So the day in which Bad Art Friend was published, maybe a day or two afterwards, I follow on Facebook, I follow Carly Finlay, who is a disability activist, who I think is just the fucking bomb. She's like amazing and so insightful, and like I just worship her. So she wrote a very quick kind of post about, she basically prefaced the post by saying, I'm about to post a unpopular opinion. And then she said, Bad Art Friend, I don't think much about it. What do you guys all think? And then I thought, okay, what is this? I read a little bit about it. And I remember seeing it on my Autumn feed. You know how I subscribe to Autumn, which reads out great articles to you by professional, I swear I talk about it all the time, by professional voice artists. So I saw it and the article was called like the donor and the borrower or something, like on the feed. And so like I didn't think anything of it. It just seemed kind of boring. A few, like maybe a day after that, my friend Sarah Dingle, who's a fucking genius also, she texted me about it and asked me what I thought about it. And so I said, okay, I better go and listen to it. And so I did. And yeah, I had a lot of opinions. So before we talk about it, Helen, let's dish out to our readers basically what the story is all about.
Yeah, I came across through a Facebook post as well, saying, asking what my opinions is. And I quickly send you the piece as well. And I tried to find a way that I can read or listen to the piece, because I wasn't, like, I unsubscribed New York Times last month. So I couldn't access it after I reading like 5 or 10 articles. And I was so eager to get on top of it. And I think I asked you, oh, have you got a subscription? I was just asking around people if they can send it, like the copy to me. And I couldn't wait for it anymore. I just said, oh, fuck it. I'll just subscribe again for the sake of wanting to read this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's worth
it. I'm so amazed on how many like different subjects arises or sparked from this huge saga and the different perspectives as well, the different journalists focus on the variety of point of the story. So what happened was that I don't even know how to start. It's basically
Let's start with Dawn Dosland.
It was a small incident between two riders in Boston.
Dorland.
Where they have a private Facebook group. And Dolan was the rider who donated her kidney indirectly. There's direct donation and there's indirect donation, which I only know now, that she donated her kidney to a stranger.
Mm.
And because I still don't understand her intention, to be honest. She put her story onto this private group and sharing it to the group of riders. And for some reason, Larson, which is another rider.
Mm. Sonia Larson. Who we should preface by saying she's Asian American. She's half Asian, half white.
Yeah, she was in the middle of working some of her stories, and the intention of Dolan, I still don't understand why she have to put it onto a private group and telling her story about her donation of kidney.
Mm.
And Larson kind of, from what we see, okay, honestly, we still don't know the truth. We're just telling our listeners now from the sources that we've been reading. Larson picked up the story. She kind of incorporated that part of kidney donation into her story or her novel. I think it was a novel.
It was a short story. It was called The Kindest. Mm-hmm. And what happened basically was they're loosely in the same writer circles, right? And the kind of writing center, Grub Street in Boston, is I've actually taken a couple of classes at Grub Street. I don't know any of the writers, but it's like, first of all, it's a very small world. Like the writers within writers in these communities, even though it's Boston, you know, writers all know each other parochially. What happened? Yeah, like Helen said, Dawn Dorland was a white woman who donated her kidney, and then like for the next few months afterwards, she kind of, the way in which Robert Kohler writes it in the article, it was almost like Dawn expected some praise for her act of kindness, like donating a kidney to an anonymous person. And a few months after, maybe a year after, she heard that Sonia Larson had wrote a short story that had become quite successful. And it was like being published around all over the place about an Asian woman who is kind of like, it's a story about an Asian woman who's messed up and then receives a kidney from an anonymous donor. And then one day she receives a letter from the white anonymous donor saying, oh, can we be friends? Mm-hmm. And what Sonia Larson did, and what is really at the crux of the sort of litigious actions that have been going on between these two women for years and years, is basically that Sonia Larson took a, like, word for word, I swear it was almost word for word, a message that Dawn Dorland wrote in the private Facebook chat to her. Mm-hmm. And it was something about her motivation for donating a kidney. And so, like, so what ends up happening is, like, back and forth suing, like, Dawn sues Larson, Sonia, for, like, appropriating her work or, like, her words, basically.
Plagiarism.
And then Sonia Larson gets lawyers to counter-sue Dawn Dorland defamation.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, this whole article, what I found really funny was on Carly Finlay's Facebook feed, a lot of people said, oh, it was too long, I couldn't read it, because it's over 10,000 words.
It's very long. Actually listened to it. It took me just a little bit over an hour.
Yeah, it's an hour and 4 minutes.
So long.
On Autumn, yeah. And I found it okay to listen to that because I'm used to listening to long-form articles. But I would absolutely empathize with those people who could not be bothered to read the whole thing because it's like reading like a half a book, basically.
Definitely.
In some cases, you know? Yeah.
Yes.
I swear, Helen, after like – so that's basically, to wrap it up, listeners, that's the extent of the story. You know, there's counter-suing, there's suing, and this goes on for years and years.
It's so messy. Yeah,
it's so messy. And so basically what the world since the publication of this article maybe 2 weeks ago, there has been like countless articles written about Bad Our Friend. This is like what's colloquially being called now online. And what I have to say, Helen, coming out from my first reading of the story was, I am so glad I'm not in that world. Like, I'm so glad yeah. I'm not part. I'm number one. I'm so glad I'm not either Sonia or Dawn. Number mm-hmm. two, it seems like I'm not at all to diminish either woman's experiences
mm.
because like any person's experience is a big experience in their lives. I don't diminish mm-hmm. that at all. But like for me as an outsider, I was just like, oh my God, this is so petty. Seems very petty, but you know, of course it isn't because, you know, there are people's lives we're dealing with. And like nobody, I'm sure all our listeners know, the worst case scenario in anyone's life is like beyond death and illness is to be mm-hmm. sued. Honestly, like mm-hmm. you do not want to get yourself caught up in litigious actions if you can avoid mm-hmm. it because
that's
the
right.
legal system will make your life absolutely
miserable.
Absolutely yeah. miserable. Yeah, yeah, you're right. And this whole saga, like Helen said, and that's a great word to express this, to describe this whole story, is that people are debating online who is the bad our friend, like who mm-hmm. is the one who yeah. like deserves more of our hatred, I guess, or like more mm. of our blame, like who is morally wrong here.
Yeah.
The woman who like sued the woman who took a few words line from her private chat, or is it the woman who actually took words out of a like something that you would expect to be confidential when you, you know, mm-hmm. type a Facebook chat to someone.
Yeah.
You expect things to be confidential. You don't expect mm-hmm. someone to take it in and put it yeah. into their art form, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, my just before I hear your ranting, mm-hmm. I'll just finish up by saying in my initial reading, I have to say that I kind of blamed, and maybe this is me obviously, you know, finding solidarity with the Asian here.
Mm-hmm.
But my sympathy was more towards Sonia Larson. Like I thought I was more on her side, I have to say, mm-hmm. initially. I don't know how I feel about it now, but the way in which Robert Kohler expresses these two women in his article, for me, I was just like, wow, like I'm not sure. I don't know Dawn at all, and I'm not about to criticize her. But the character of Dawn, from the way in which Robert Kohler expresses it in his article, it makes me not really think highly of her, only in the sense that she seemed very jealous of Sonia's success. Like she mm-hmm. seemed like a very jealous person who just really wanted to be the center of the fact, her act of donating a kidney. Like it seemed as though Dawn really wanted the world to know that, you know, she donated a kidney and that she deserves mm. some sort of higher credit. And also, heads up, if you don't know, Dawn Dorland is also a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I get yeah. it. I get it. Like when other writers around Australia are successful, like, and they're young like me, I get jealous. Like no doubt about it. Like I can't, I'm a human being. I get jealous. I hate jealousy. I hate it. I wish I never felt it, but it's natural.
Mm-hmm. It's a competitive world after yeah. all. You know, the first thing that I thought, actually this thought came to me when I was doing the notes for this episode. I thought that, well, Jesus, this is like Squid Game for the writers.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just going to quote quickly from The Guardian. Like there's heaps, like Jesse said, there's enormous amount of articles came out after Bad Art Friend was published. I'm going to quote here a piece from Guardian by Emma Brooks. She said that Dolan versus Larson pulled a lot of unconvincing culture war stuff around white saviorism.
Mm.
The exercise of privilege, the bullying of a less successful writer by her more successful peer, and something that could just about credibly reach the level of interesting. Dolan evoked Larson's scorn in the first instance by doing laudable things, donating a kidney before attracting accusations of narcissism, by banging on about too much on the Facebook. There is something exquisitely modern about this, the elevation of attitude over action as the primary marker of virtue.
I love
that. There's so many aspects in this whole mess, apart from the donation of kidney, that we would really talk about what is... what's the word? Altruistic
yeah.
behavior. Like, should organ donors be bragging about what they've been doing? Because sometimes it seems like you're doing it for getting attention rather than you're doing it for the benefit of the person who's receiving your organ. Yeah, I've seen a couple of tweets, people saying that, oh yeah, I've had friends doing that before, you know, they make a donation to a charity and they have to post it and they expect people to give them likes or commenting or praising on them.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's this article that I read from The Slate. There's a writer called Magda Samuro. They say that you should brag about it because there's a kidney surplus among healthy people. So if we're looking specifically on kidney donations in US, of course that they want the industry or the medical industry want people to really talk about it, to open it up, to talk about the importance of donation. Okay, so that's one side of the story. And you also would consider like the discussion around the ethical issues on organ donating.
I guess
the debate continues because some people will say how to compensate the donors and how to praise the donors, what's the actual motive of the donors, and also it could potentially lead to exploitation of organ donation, you know, the organ exploitation that we see in third world countries. I mean, it's nice to openly talk about it, but to the point that people, other people feel like, geez, that's a bit too much. So another aspect in this whole mess was the group chat that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
The Katie talks about behind someone's back.
Yeah.
One tweet that I saw.
Was it from Celeste Ng?
No. I read her tweet. But so everyone can go on and look it up. But this tweet from Courtney Milan, I think she's just usual, you know, normal, like public citizen.
Yeah.
She said that, "I'm not gonna say anything about that one article that's going around, except that if you value your mental health, you should never ever subpoena someone else's group chat about yourself." Because what happened in this whole back and forth story, the group chat was subpoenaed to the court to actually check what Larson was talking within their group of writer friends. About Dawson. That's came up publicly for people to make judgments.
It's
so messy.
I know. That is like my worst nightmare. Imagine that. Just like your most private, like flippant opinions. Like just think about the times you like type out things without really thinking about it.
Thought about it,
And now it's being like held up in the law of court, like core of law, whatever you call it. It's just like fucking anxiety inducing.
I mean, there's a lot of chat that just in the moment of frustration, I guess, sometimes you just type it and then your friends, like in this incident that the writer's friends were supporting Larson and they were talking behind Dolan. So that was quite, I don't even know how to find a word to describe it. That was quite nasty if you're at the receiving end, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, do you want to really quickly talk about, I thought it was really interesting, Celeste Ng. So Celeste Ng is probably the most famous writer that's mentioned in this article. She's the she's the author of Little Fires Everywhere and...
And she's the friend of Sonia Larson.
Yeah, she's kind of a... Yeah, she's closer to Sonia Larson, yeah. So if you don't know, Celeste Ng also is the woman who tweeted she's not attracted to Asian men because... they remind her of her cousins. controversial.
But he's on the cut.
But Helen sent me a tweet that she wrote that I thought was really worthwhile in replaying. Helen, do you want to?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me.
Okay. Yeah, she said something like, "I'm so sick of being asked this, so I'm just going to lay it out there." And then she says, I think she makes two points, but one of the points, the second one maybe, was like, where none of us are really friends with Dawn Dorland, and I have not really even heard that name since this article came out.
What do you think of that?
Well, I just, it makes me think that they weren't really friends. You know, that even though I do agree that what Sonia did, taking an actual line from a group chat, like a private chat, into a work of art is a bit overstepping the line, I don't think that it merits the consequence in which she has faced since that. And I think it's really interesting to register Celeste Ng's tweet because there is no real actual friendship there. Like, they're not that close, basically, is what kind of is being established by Celeste Ng's tweet. Like, Sonia and Dawn are not really that close.
Yeah, somewhere that I read about an opinion about the bad art friend was saying that it's all down to economic, political issues that tragically that it has, you know, the recession of the whole world have become like this for even the writing industry, that people pit each other. Like I said before, it's like a Squid Game in making for the publishing and writers industry. There's more people getting into writing, but there's the stagnated number of readers. And of course, there's not enough pay. The distribution of the work and credit is very unequal. I don't even want to start with calling a couple of white writers who gets more attention. But it is the fact that even one journalist said that this is a kind of poisonous behavior, exactly what happens when human being forced to compete to scraps at the steadily dwindling economic banquet, like from Depression era Germany to Yugoslavia to the modern USA.
Yeah. So we'd love to hear your thoughts, listeners, once you read it. Or honestly, it's just, it's worth considering diving into it. I mean, really, what's an hour? Like, people, you spend an hour watching an episode of Homeland, right? Come on, guys. So we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with our final topic of today on the topic of Sam Frost. There's a lot to chat and unpack there. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, we're back. And before, I really want to talk to listeners and Helen about Sam Frost saga. I want to just like brush through some of the things we've been reading this week. So I've been reading Emma McBride's nonfiction, very short essay book called Something Out of Place, which is her take on like the origins of female shame and how our bodies are often shamed and like this idea of disgust and where it comes from. I've just started it and it's so far very good. I just finished a review book by Heather Morris. Another book that I will mention is, so it's the third book to her kind of Auschwitz trilogy. She's the woman who wrote The Tattooist of Auschwitz. Have you heard that book? Apparently it sold like 6 million copies. Yeah, neither. I haven't read her previous two books, but this one is a review book, so I had to read it, and it was good. Like, it's very, very easy to read. It's very easy to read. So it was quite, interesting to read something that I guess I wouldn't usually read. So let's move on to Sam Frost. So basically the story of Sam Frost in the last week, why she's made such a big headlines is because last weekend, Sam Frost, if you don't know, y'all out there, you don't need to, she is a ex-bachelorette candidate. I think she got rejected by this guy called Blake. Anyway, so she's famous for being like on this show. And then I believe she's now a mother and she's quite like, she has 500,000 Instagram followers. And so she's like an influencer basically. And she's blonde, very beautiful, like attractive. And so she is anti-vax. And on Saturday last week, she posted a video of herself on Instagram where she's like sitting on the floor with a backdrop of books and she's all wearing all white, not a lot of makeup on her face. And she's basically saying like, I feel really dehumanized. But she basically said, oh, I don't feel human that, you know, now that we're opening up here in Sydney, like I feel discriminated against. And she used the word, the main crux of the controversy around her video is the fact that she used the word segregation flippantly. Like she just kind of casually threw that out. And she said, I feel like there's segregation. I'm being segregated against as a person who's not being vaxxed. So for you guys who don't know, in Sydney, people who are double vaxxed can now go out and do shit. If you can't prove your double vaxxed, you have to wait until December 1st in order to access all the things that, you know, society, like going out to pubs, privileges, going to yoga, movies, etc. Yeah, privileges, basically. Yeah. And at one point, Sam cries a little bit in the video. The video is about three, four minutes. Anyway, I have watched this video.
Oh, have you?
I learned about it through, the story about this from my editor, Tala Lambert, who at Women's Gender, who wrote a piece about how being critical of the use of the word segregation by Sam. And I'm completely in support of, I support people who think that Sam was wrong in using that term. That's as much as I'll say for now, But before I hand it over to Helen, because I have ranted on a little bit, I just want to say that I think on Monday or Tuesday, Sam Frost actually cut her Instagram account completely. So when you try and access it, it's like she's basically shut herself down. Since then, you know, there have been people supporting her. There have been pretty people who are criticizing her, like left, right, center. It's been a massive debate online. Mm-hmm. Helen, what are your thoughts?
Okay. Yeah, I know very little about this person and I don't have anything against her, but I do not like how she has a huge influence on social media platform and then trying to make yourself marginalized because of your own choice and making yourself as a victim is not really my cup of tea to really amplify that kind of voice.
I agree.
And I think there are people coming out and saying that, yeah, it's okay to use the word segregation because segregate, if you use it for verb, it is literally dividing people. But in historically, segregation has been the ones that been determined by the people of power to the people who has no choice but to be segregated. When you have a choice to get a vaccination and not risking the health of the public, general public, and you choose not to do that, you're risking a the health risk to the public and you're saying that you're victimized. It's, I don't know what to say about that. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, there's this part where a lot of people are like saying in one of the, in, I think part of the videos, there's a point where Sam says, my body, my choice. And usually under any circumstances, I would agree with that, Helen. But the thing is, someone in your family who's really, really hating, I won't mention who, but someone who, like, completely, like, violently against anti-vaccines.
It's very science-based.
It's not, like, it's not your body, your choice, because when you're not vaccinated, you're putting other people's health
at risk. That's right.
You know, when you go out and engage and intercourse with the society. So it's not, it's not just my body, your choice. You know, you're actually influencing other people and putting their lives at risk.
Yeah.
I also go on, hop onto the fact that Helen mentioned, yeah, like technically the word segregation is simply, you know, purely dictionary speaking, dictionarily speaking, separating two groups of people. However, or two groups of entities, you know, the segregation of animals towards humans, against humans. But the thing is, like Helen said, the word segregation is so weighted in history, you know, like, and I think, I honestly think, like, I think my editor Tala says this in her piece as well, like, honestly, like, perhaps Sam just made a mistake, like we all do, like, she just didn't know, she just wasn't someone who, like, for me, the way in which Sam Frost used the word segregation, just, I'm not criticizing her. Like, I have nothing against Sam Frost, but for me, what it only, the only thing that clearly shows me by her use of the word segregation and the way that she casually throws it into her video is the only thing that it makes clear to me is that she's not someone who is, who reads a lot about history.
Mm-hmm.
As in, like, reads a lot about history of, you know, civil rights, history of racism. Mm-hmm. Like, she just, for me, it just means she's not someone who is very actively learned in history, and like, as in not just like history, like, and there's different sorts of history, you know, African history, Asian history. Yeah. I'm just like, I guess like, end this tongue twisting rant of mine. I guess I'm just saying it just, for her, me, it just shows that she's not widely read.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like someone who is widely read and knows about history, you know, civil rights, black rights, feminism, intersectional, you know, identities, they would not have used that word because they would know what that means.
Yeah.
You know, like, that they would understand the historical weight of that word and not use it. So just the fact that she used it just to me, just signifies to me that she doesn't read, probably. Mm-hmm.
I think during this time when there's a division of people who uses the word segregation and discrimination to express their frustration about how government is trying to keep the public health and to, you know, minimize the risk for overall citizens, I think it's just very irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
And Even this morning, I've read there was a news about how anti-vax. You know how there's going to be a court. There's going to be a case that going through the court this afternoon about mandating.
About what?
Mandating the vaccination at some workplace, and there's already anti-vaxxers.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Fabricating court transcript saying that there are medical experts saying that it is a higher risk when you get a vaccine, but which is not. It's all fabricated. So it's really
high risk. What do you mean?
As in the people who have been. This is not true. Okay, so please don't cut and paste my words. This is what I'm worried about when we speak publicly, because there's the anti-vaxxers. They're just taking it out of context, and they will cut and paste your words and make it fabricated, saying that this is why the vaccine is dangerous. So they kind of cut and paste and fabricate a. Medical experts' sentences saying that the vaccine is 13 once you've been vaccinated, it's 13 times higher that you're going to spread the virus, which is not true.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's got to the point that I don't know. This is going to sound controversial for me to say.
Go ahead, say it.
But if you don't want to take a vaccine, okay, stay in your own place and keep yourself safe. But don't go out and terrorize other people and creating fear
and
fabricating fake news, false information to make it worse. We're about to open the borders. I have no idea what's going to happen.
And
and if you're not vaccinated, and I don't know, good luck.
Yeah. I mean, It's really interesting. There are a couple of people who have like spoken out against Sam Frost, and then they have said that they've never endured so much bullying. Like there's this sort of domestic violence activist on Twitter who's quite prominent, and he said in a tweet that he's been receiving copping a lot just for like calling Sam Frost out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's again. It's kind of like it's kind of sort of related to what Helen and I were speaking about earlier about the online debates about who is the bad art friend in our previous story. But yeah, it feels like it's so hard to have any opinion now without people attacking you left, right, center. Hence my absolute delight in never being online on Twitter or social media. I just think it's such a messy place, and I'm very glad that I'm like not part of that noise. Yeah, what have you seen in your spaces, Helen, around your kind of social media circles about this issue of Sam Frost? What do you think? Well, do you think people are too hard on her?
I think,
do you think
most of the things, I don't know if it's probably because I'm still very much in my own echo chamber, so I haven't really I have seen one or two Instagram or TikTok videos defending Sam Frost's behavior, saying that she might have mental health issue. Why is everyone attacking her? But it does make me think that does claiming yourself to have mental health issue justify your decision not to be vaccinated or imposing a health risk to the public? Because essentially, your words have a power to influence people. And also, if you do have the medical exemption, and I show that there are people out there do, that you cannot be vaccinated, you can present the proof of, saying that you're medically exempt to get the vaccination. Because your choice, for those anti-vaxxers, your choice of not to get vaccinated just because you don't want to, not only poses risk for the rest of the public that has vaccinated, it poses higher risk for those who cannot be vaccinated. For example, at the moment, a lot of kids, children under 12 cannot be vaccinated.
And also
the communities that have not received vaccination yet. For example, indigenous communities, you're posing a higher risk for them. And I just hope that they understand.
Yeah. And clearly she doesn't, I think. You're right. Absolutely. And I think it's, like this whole 12 months with the whole COVID thing has really kind of risen the identity group of anti-vaxxers so high. Because I just remember like in the past, like when we think of anti-vax communities, we just think of Byron, yeah. At least here in Australia, Byron Bay is like the hub of hippies who don't believe in modern medicine. But like, I also thought, Helen, that this idea of this sort of historical scientific history of vaccinations, like, it's like, I'm just thinking the kind of miracle of vaccinations, like if we still had smallpox and measles and cholera, polio. You know, all those things that killed like so many percentage of the population now just rarely, I mean, it still does unfortunately exist in developing countries, but just like by and by the whole, those kind of diseases that used to wipe out entire communities and populations of people no longer are almost completely eradicated because of vaccines. Mm-hmm. You know, so like I guess what I'm saying is I'm not someone who is suspicious of vaccines. Mm-hmm. That's all I'm saying. I'm not someone who is generally like if there's a vaccine that helps cure us or save us from some sort of disease or illness, I'm usually quite like eager to find out how it can actually make the world a safer place for mm-hmm. all. Then rather than saying, oh, it's a conspiracy or it's going to give my kid autism or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Until those anti-vaxxers come out and prove their point scientifically that they have they have gone through medical degrees, then maybe I'll listen to them. But most of them has no medical background. So I don't know where they got their information from. Yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder, because Sam Frost in her video, she doesn't actually say why she's not getting vaccinated. She just says there are many, 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 and she says a lot of many reasons why she's not vaccinated and why other people who choose not to be vaccinated are not getting vaccinated. But she never says it.
Give us a reason, then we can actually talk about it and explore your hesitancy. Yeah, but if they don't, then... You know, that's the end of a conversation. We can't even continue the conversation. Yeah.
And like, I get it. It's her right to not talk about the reason if she doesn't want to. But since you're giving yourself that platform, why don't just take it all the way? Mm-hmm. You know.
Okay. Anything else?
Yeah, that's generally my opinion. Here we are loading on the opinions.
Okay, so that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you have enjoyed our show. We welcome listeners to send us your feedbacks and topics you would like us to explore. Check out our updates on the socials and make sure you share with your friends to help us to extend the visibility of Asian Bitches Down Under. And also continue the intersectionality of the podcast industry. So we'll chat to you next time. Stay safe, everyone.
Yeah, looking forward to it. The beach, Sydneysiders, it will still be there in a few weeks' time. Don't panic. Just ride out this London weather.
Okay, chat to you next week. Bye.
Bye. Ciao, ciao.